All right, welcome everyone. Good evening. My name is Nina Khoury. I'm a member of faculty here. I teach in our expanding dispute resolution program, primarily mediation at the undergraduate and postgraduate levels. And so I'm particularly delighted to be able to chair this evening's talk by our distinguished guest, Professor Tom Stepanovic. He is speaking on the topic of international mediation and... Come in, please. All of you here will be well familiar with the explosion in domestic mediation throughout common law countries in the last 30 to 40 years because of all the familiar reasons of cost of litigation, the desire for privacy, the flexibility of the process, and the potential for parties to craft tailor-made solutions that suit their own needs. When you think about those factors, they are writ large when it comes to international disputes. And so international mediation, in turn, has really exploded over the last, say, 10 to 20 years. You know that a field has matured when there is an international competition for law schools in it. So the International Chamber of Commerce now runs the International Commercial Mediation Competition. Forgive me, but I have to plug that our law school has done very well in it in the last 2 years. I can't resist that. But what happens is that you have this new field and there are very few scholars and academics actually asking the important questions. So it is particularly exciting to have one of the leading international scholars here with us tonight. And so Professor Stepanovic, he is chair in law at Pepperdine University as well as the academic director of the Strauss Institute at Pepperdine. Now Pepperdine, for those of you who may not know, is ranked number one in America for its academic dispute resolution programs. He is the quintessential pracademic, if I could say that.
Please.
He has made a number of really important academic contributions to the field, books and articles and so on, but he also is an experienced mediator and arbitrator. So he is well qualified to speak on the topic that he is speaking to us about tonight. Before I invite him to speak to you, I would like to acknowledge the assistance of the New Zealand Law Foundation in bringing Professor Stepanovic to us and Christina Muller from the Law Foundation. Please.
I just want to welcome Professor Stepanovic. This is the third year the Law Foundation has sponsored a speaker in this area. It isn't a large area in New Zealand, but we think it's very important. I was fortunate enough to be at a talk the professor gave on Monday in Wellington about three Hollywood stars and their dealings with the contract system there. Olivia de Havilland, Betty Davis, and James Cagney. The people you see tonight, if there are any, won't be quite as glamorous, but the topic is nonetheless important, and we're delighted to be able to fund and Professor Stepanovic, and thank the universities for the work they've done in putting these events together, both in Wellington and in Auckland.
Please join with me in welcoming Professor.
Well, it's a sincere delight to be here. There's nothing I like better than to be with friends talking about something I'm passionate about and that many of us are. And I can't think of, oh, thank you. I can't think of a better place to be than the University of Auckland Law Faculty. And I want to extend my thanks, by the way, for their hosting this event. Christina, I can't thank you enough. For the Law Foundation for making this possible. I think it's a marvelous idea. My friends Lucy Reed and Catherine Rogers led the way before me, and I'm confident there'll be a lot of other people who were able to enjoy coming to New Zealand and spending time with all of you. But this is so far been an absolute delight, and I look forward to talking to some of you after the program tonight. I want to make this an interactive program, and I know Nina will enable that a little bit later. I'm going to go through and show you a few slides and throw out a bunch of ideas to you about the evolution of mediation. Nina actually gave you a preview of the first part of my talk, which is great, and I'm on the right track, Nina. We're going to talk about what I call the quiet revolution in dispute resolution, some of its roots I will, of course, from time to time provide what I think is a quintessentially American perspective, but I also want to talk about the way some of the trends and developments that I see occurring internationally, including the ICC moot that Nina was talking about. So let's begin by discussing the roots of this quiet revolution and dispute resolution. You know, it's interesting that Nina mentioned, I think, 34 years or thereabouts as this period during which we have what I call the era of modern mediation or the quiet revolution. A returning to what I think are very elemental concepts of conflict management. It just so happens that that period of 34 years is the precise amount of time since I graduated from law school. So my own career has been almost precisely coterminous with what I would describe as this period of the Quiet Revolution. And again, turning back to what's happening in the United States, some years ago, the American Bar Association section of litigation put on a symposium, and they called it the Vanishing Trial. And of course, there were a variety of perspectives presented on this, and I was talking about the role of what we call ADR. How many of you are familiar with that term? I assume many of you are. Of course, I have to tell you, I have a love-hate relationship with that term because I think it's on one level, too inclusive and too vague, and in some other ways, perhaps not broad enough. This initialism essentially came out of the term alternative dispute resolution. Of course, the alternative was trial, as if this was the way things always happened. The trial bar was very concerned that they simply weren't having as many trials in the United States. Now, of course, if you go further back, you see that, well, this whole thing is somewhat cyclical and circumstantial, but we had a significant retraction in the incidence of trial. That doesn't mean there were fewer filings. There were actually more people filing complaints in court. There were simply fewer incidences of trial. And, of course, part of it is cost-related, concerns about the cost of discovery, although, ironically, in many cases, disputes aren't resolved until very late in the process of information exchange or discovery. The risks and uncertainties associated with an adjudication by a judge or more particularly by a jury. And finally, concerns about business and impact on relationships. This is not a new concern. Another area of study for me is Abraham Lincoln, a fellow Illinoisan, at least we claim him, as do a number of states. But Lincoln traveled a circuit in Illinois. Lincoln was out riding on horseback, going from courthouse to courthouse in the 1830s and 1840s. In fact, many people don't know that he was actually still receiving correspondence on certain litigation as late as 1863, when he was in the middle of the Civil War as the president of our country. Lincoln was a phenomenal trial lawyer, by all accounts, and I've seen many, many accounts of his work in courts. He was also a fantastic appellate lawyer. This was a brilliant man. He would stay up at night and read Euclid's Principles of Geometry for fun. So not your typical individual, but had an extremely acute mind. He said to his clients and to other lawyers, discourage litigation. Persuade your neighbors to compromise whenever you can. Point out to them how the nominal winner is often a real loser in fees, expenses, and waste of time. As a peacemaker, the lawyer has a superior opportunity of being a good man. Remember in 1850 when he wrote these words, they were all men. And there will still be business enough. Well, Lincoln could have been speaking, not in 1850, but in 1980 or 1990 or 2000 or today. These are things we think about constantly. I have the privilege, as a young lawyer, of beginning to use a lot of different tools. My background is in architecture, and as it happened, I became a litigator specializing in usually complex construction disputes. And the construction industry and construction litigation has always been something out of the ordinary. There's always been an emphasis on alternative procedures because of the costs associated with court, the fact that you may not have someone deciding the case who knows anything about construction and in fact is rather upset about the whole idea of having to deal with it. And so there have been a whole variety of different experiments with different kinds of procedures, including most of those that are set out here. I'm not going to take the time to go through all of those because tonight our focus is on mediation, which normally means facilitated negotiation of a dispute with the idea of trying to promote a settlement of that dispute by the parties. Now, there are other forms of mediation. There are other ways of measuring success or an endpoint in mediation. Mediation has the capability, as we'll see, of transforming relationships and accomplishing other goals. But most often when trial lawyers, when problem-solving lawyers talk about mediation, they're talking about facilitated negotiation aimed at settlement. I have to tell you that in those heady days of the 1980s and early 1990s, I would often hear people talk in terms like this. We have the opportunity to turn from a system that is advocate-controlled, adversarial, formalized, intensely rights-based, and of course lengthy and costly, to one that puts clients, disputants themselves, in the driver's seat, focusing on cooperation, on relationships, in an informal approach, looking at interests, in a flexible, offering flexibility. And you heard Nina refer to the inherent flexibility of mediation as a process. Early, expeditious, efficient. These were all things we were talking about. We were saying, let's turn the world upside down. Do something very, very different than we've been doing. Well, over a period of decades, we have seen the evolution in the United States and, of course, in a variety of jurisdictions, although, as Nina mentioned, most intensely, most prominently, common law countries. The U.S., the U.K., Canada, New Zealand, Australia. These are the places where mediation has taken root most fervently. We see the evolution of mediation in connection with, in my country, federal and state court programs. It's very hard to find a court program that or a court system that does not have some kind of mediation program. Even at the appellate level, there will often be mediators, including staff mediators. There are hundreds of federal and state agency programs that employ forms of mediation. I can tell you from my own experience, having worked fairly closely with a lot of corporations and corporate counsel, particularly among larger businesses, there's a great deal of acquaintance with mediation. We'll talk about this a little bit later on. Today it's hard to find contracts, commercial contracts, certainly in the U.S., but increasingly internationally, that include steps for dispute resolution, perhaps beginning with some form of negotiation between business people, perhaps followed by negotiation, and then eventually some kind of adjudication, often arbitration. And of course, we have an immense array of providers of services. These may be individuals who are offering their mediation skills, or it may be large organizations that provide dispute resolution services, maybe support the activities of many mediators. As Nina said, there are also a growing number of educational and training institutions, a true proliferation. In fact, I will just pause and say, I'm at the Strauss Institute for Dispute Resolution at Pepperdine School of Law. And I think we have the largest or broadest program of its kind, perhaps anywhere. Believe it or not, we actually today have, in any given year, about 45 different courses on subjects ranging from negotiation theory and practice to mediation courses of different kinds, a wide variety of arbitration courses, psychology of conflict, cross-cultural conflict, communication and conflict. It goes on and on. And we offer a couple of different master's degrees and a certification. So that is on one end of the spectrum in terms of all of the different programs that are available. But these are developing all over the world, and they will continue to do so. Nina also presaged which is my own very alliterative list of reasons why people mediate, or the potential benefits of mediation: control over process and result, the ability to customize a process, confidentiality, which is so important, particularly to businesses who may be disputing over intellectual property rights, which need to be kept very private, communications, the ability to bridge over cultures, addressing commercial realities and business needs, savings of cost and time, lower risk, creative, durable solutions, and finally, the ability to emphasize relationships. Now, how many of you do mediate play a role in mediation? Let me see your hands. Okay, a number of you. In my own experience as a mediator, I can tell you that I'm always looking for opportunities to do creative things in mediation. Often I'm not able to. I may, however, be able, even in the course of driving, helping to facilitate a distributive bargain, which ends up in an exchange of money. Insights that come into play involving the drivers of conflict will often help with that. Which brings me to this little illustration. We talk a lot about about getting people to focus below the line. You know, much of law school, how many law students do we have here tonight? You know, in our legal careers, we begin by learning legal precepts, legal principles. And in the typical course that I teach, in contracts, for example, or remedies, we often look at appellate court opinions or other judicial opinions, which are dealing with certain factual situations that involve application of legal principles. Our focus is on rights and obligations of the parties and how they may be adjusted or addressed by courts of law. And our role in helping to represent parties in those processes. That, however, is only part of the picture, and indeed I might suggest the tip of the iceberg when you're thinking about people as human beings with needs, interests, emotions, drivers. There's all kinds of other stuff that's going on below the line, particularly where you have an ongoing relationship of some sort. There may be a tremendous impetus toward trying to keep the relationship going, either because of for personal reasons, as in a parenting relationship, or economic and other reasons. The great potential for mediation is in dealing not only with those rights and obligations above the line, at least by creating a settlement that takes into account what might happen in a court of law. It may involve an exchange of money of some sort, but all of those other factors, and I'll come back and talk about that a little bit later on, all the ways in which mediators or the skills of mediators may come into play. Some years ago, one of our outstanding academic authors, one of our most insightful scholars, said, Mediation's got the capacity to reorient parties toward each other, not by imposing rules on them, but by helping them to achieve a new and shared perception of their relationship, a perception that will redirect their attitudes and dispositions to each other. A colleague of mine did a study some years ago about the ability of mediation to restore a ruptured relationship of some kind. Here are the results of the initial survey he did. Although in many cases the parties reached impasse, and in some other places there was merely an exchange of money, non-integrative terms, as he said, in some other cases they were able to achieve more. There might be some kind of in-kind exchange or an apology, or there might be in around a fifth of the cases a repaired relationship. We'll talk more about the characteristics of those because I want to come back toward the end of my lecture and touch on that. I have a passion for numbers and learning more about these processes and practices and perspectives in operation. So in 2014, my institute conducted a survey of an organization called the International Academy of Mediators. And in the ranks of the IAM are a number of Kiwis among mediators from other parts of the world. About 153 people were surveyed. 85% are participated. I thought you might be interested to see the makeup of that group. Now, the U.S. Might be accused of getting this whole thing started, and we certainly are heavily engaged. We're certainly into mediation, and this is reflected in this chart. You see about three-quarters of the membership of this organization are U.S. citizens. And then, of course, you'll see there Australia, New Zealand, and the Pacific Islands are represented on that chart, as well as other parts of the world. Interestingly, if you look at the United States and the breakdown of mediators there, what do you see? I don't know if those of you in the back can read the small print there, but California is by far the epicenter of mediation in the United States. I've lived all over the country, and I have to say that coming to California, I realized I had come to ground zero of mediation. And it's super saturated, frankly, in Southern California. But you have a court system that since the 1980s has been referring cases in the tens of thousands every year to mediation. So even back in 1990, there were over 1,000 providers of mediation services in the Los Angeles area, according to the RAND Corporation. Then, of course, if you look at what's going on in Europe, we did a breakdown of EU countries, and of course, the United Kingdom leads the way. My good friend, Tony Willis, who is here with us, a fellow New Zealander, is right at the top of mediators operating out of London and, frankly, the world. But while mediation is evolving in the EU, and we're beginning to see lots of developments more and more rapidly in civil law countries, there's no question that the United Kingdom is far advanced. What I'm going to do is very quickly go through a number of parameters to show you what the demographics of this group. You'll see that the typical mediator is, the bulk of them are somewhere between 50 and their 60s, although some are actually quite young, like Nina. And I think there are plenty of opportunities for young people who are, as I'm constantly telling my students, who are interested in trying to begin to develop these opportunities. You have to be opportunistic because you never know when they might occur. And as you see, a number of people were doing, were mediating as much as 35, even 40 years ago, but it really began in the late 70s. And that's what's reflected here. The mediators in this organization, like many mediators internationally, are approaching it as a profession. So you have about 90% of this group that are working full-time. And if you look at how they're working, at least 70% of this group spend 70 or more percent of their time as mediators. So they may be arbitrating and doing other things. Some also are in law practice. But the fact is that they are dispute resolvers. The number of cases that some people have handled, particularly in places like Southern California, are extraordinary. It's not unusual to find people that have handled 1,000, 2,000, even 3,000 or 4,000 cases, which boggles the mind. But nevertheless, that's reflected in the chart. Also, here is indicators of numbers of cases handled a year. And as you can see, some people seem to be mediating a different case almost every day on the high end. Others a couple of times a week. And of course, there's a wide variety of different kinds of disputes represented here. I won't take the time to go through this, but as you see, there are many, many different kinds of cases. Also, what I've shown on this chart, by the way, are just medians, median numbers, rather than show you a full distribution of all of the different responses. But as you can see, there's a wide array of case values that are reflected here, up to hundreds of millions or more. Another thing that surprised me was the fact that so many members of the IAM actually have experience with class actions and mediating cases involving classes of plaintiffs or classes of disputants. This is, of course, something that is well established in the United States, the concept of the class action. But in many countries, it's not. Although that's an issue in evolution. It's been a rather controversial practice in the United States, but nevertheless is promoted as a way of bringing people together for the purpose of pursuing claims as a class that they could not afford to pursue individually. So their mediators are involved in that. About 3 years ago, I had the opportunity to help obtain another set of data looking at users, and particularly users within large corporations. These are the world's largest companies. As it turned out, back in 1997, there had been a study that was done by Cornell University along with Pricewaterhouse. And it was a groundbreaking survey because it was the only thing that we had that really gave any indication of what was going on in large companies. What I have here is a chart that shows all of the reasons why in 2011 companies were saying they use ADR, that broad term for alternative, or as I prefer, appropriate dispute resolution. Now, I should stop here just quickly to explain that when an American talks about ADR, we are kind of unusual, and some people might say wrong-headed, in that we include binding arbitration or private adjudication in the context in under this umbrella term. So a lot of Americans would tend to think of it that way. Most other parts of the world, when people talk about ADR, they usually mean mediation or some other informal process, normally mediation. Nevertheless, because the original survey use that term, we used it again here. And so we asked people, why does your company use the ADR? And of course, there's a whole array of reasons why people use ADR. But among other things, saving time and money, control over disputes, limited discovery, confidentiality, avoiding legal precedents, more durable resolution, preserving relationships and neutral expertise, all of these things. Again, just very briefly, I will show you that, as this indicates, we asked them about how many companies were mediating different kinds of disputes. The red columns are the 1997 figures. The gold columns are the 2011 response. And what we see is that more companies were using mediation across the board in terms of different kinds of cases. One senior vice president and general counsel talked about some of the reasons why mediation has come to the fore. Cost control, ability to resolve disputes quickly, and in an effective way, a business resolution, as he said. Here are some other quotes. Often, they would compare mediation favorably to binding arbitration, or in other words, say, I like mediation better for this reason. You also see the contrast in this chart, which is frequency of use of mediation and arbitration in commercial disputes. The light blue columns represent mediation, the dark blue are binding arbitration, and I think you can see that while many companies frequently or occasionally use mediation for commercial disputes, the usage of arbitration is much less. I think more stark is the comparison when one asks companies about future use of the processes. Nearly all corporate counsel that were asked said, oh dear, my company is likely to use mediation in the future, or very likely. When we asked them the same question with respect to arbitration, there was almost a 50-50 split with respect to their likelihood or unlikelihood of using the process. Now, there are a variety of reasons why I think mediation is coming to the fore internationally, and I've alluded to them earlier, but let's go over them. The influence of counsel with mediation expertise. More and more people, more and more lawyers are learning about mediation, not just in practice, but even in law school or earlier, and they're coming out into the workforce. The expanding use of stepped dispute resolution provisions in international commercial contracts. Rapid global expansion, particularly on the supply side. We have a growing base of mediators and provider credentialing institutions and a wide variety of mediation training programs, educational programs, and, as Nina mentioned, international competitions. Now, I do have to mention very quickly an anecdote from a recent mediation training I did. We often have people come from other countries to take mediation training at my institution. Sometimes they all come from, maybe they're judges from Thailand or somewhere else, or they're just people that come from a variety of different places. Well, that was certainly true in August. In fact, we had one of your Kiwi colleagues there, as well as a number of other countries represented. There were two ladies on the front row who were from Greece and represented themselves as among the cadre, the growing cadre of Greek mediators, commercial mediators. And so I had the opportunity to talk to them at some length. And they said, yes, you know, we're really excited about mediation in Greece, and our government has gotten firmly behind it. And we have an extensive set of regulations now which promote credentialing of mediators, the training of mediators, and their preparation for practice. And I said, well, that's wonderful. How many mediators have been trained? And they said, 1,000. And all well and good. And so I said, well, and tell me now a little bit about mediation practice. You're working in the courts. And they said, yes, we're really seeking to promote the use of mediation in the courts. How many cases have been mediated? How many cases are mediated every year? And they said, well, we've mediated 15 cases. I said, you mean you've mediated 15 cases? Well, no, that's the total number of cases that have been mediated in courts in Greece. So, and I often find as I talk to people in different parts of the world, you know, things are changing very, very rapidly, and that's the important thing to keep in mind. But I'm taking soundings different places in the world. But I always try to probe and find out now what's really going on. Sometimes you have a vast supply side, but not much demand yet. And there are a variety of reasons for that. Nevertheless, things are changing, and one important development, although it hasn't yet occurred, but I think it's very, very soon to occur, is the creation of a working group to create an international convention on the enforcement of mediated settlements. Now, this is really significant, because if you think about what's happened in international commercial arbitration, one of the main reasons why we use private adjudication in international cases is that we have a regime to enforce private arbitration awards internationally that the vast majority of countries recognize. We have nothing like that for court judgments. So arbitration has really come to the fore. And I think proponents of mediation see something similar here. I briefly want to touch on three big questions relating to the growth of mediation internationally. One involves the models for mediation that will emerge from our various cultures and political regimes. Another one is the kinds of current megatrends that may affect mediation. And finally, the kinds of challenges, in light of the challenges that confront the world, how do we take the skills of a mediator and move them upstream? So let's talk about the models that have been emerging. I love this slide because this really reflects what a global society we live in, particularly in Southern California. I think actually Auckland may be even more this way. But this was a photograph of, I nearly had an accident when I took this picture. I was driving down Ventura Boulevard my first week in California, and I saw this sign, Cafe Bonjour Kosher Sushi, which says everything you need to know about Southern California. It's the ultimate melting pot, along with Auckland. Let's come back to the IAM survey and look at some key indicators here. Remember, these are mediators of commercial disputes from a variety of countries. And we ask them, okay, what is your background? Overwhelmingly, they are what? They're lawyers. Some of them are former judges. Only about 9 of the respondents to the survey did not have a legal background. By the way, if you look at our survey of arbitrators, which we did last fall, these are primarily American arbitrators. It's even more legal in focus. We look at gender. Overwhelmingly male in the commercial mediation realm, at least in this organization. I know a lot of female mediators and train with them. The fact is that I think in part because of demographics within the legal profession and the fact that you know, women not so long ago were not represented heavily in the ranks of lawyers. Even in 1980, I think only about 8% of American practitioners were women, believe it or not. That seems hard to believe today. But nevertheless, we have a gender gap here. And there's an even bigger gender gap among arbitrators. Then ethnic background. This was a shock to me. Again, leading commercial mediators from different parts of the world, and less than 2% are non-Caucasian. Again, I think if we looked at different groups of mediators, including community mediators, family mediators, we might see a different mix. But this is significant because we're talking about international mediation and resolution of international disputes. And these are people who are prominent in the field. We also ask people a little bit about the different aspects of their mediation practice. There's much, much more to talk about here, which we don't have time to discuss. But if you look at the guts of this, what you find is almost any kind of approach to mediation you can think of is represented in this group. But one of the things I want to point out is that the fact that we're dealing with people with legal backgrounds, and they're also working with lawyers, infuses a lot of the responses that we got here. For example, if you look at the bottom line here, one of the elements that some people think is important in their role as a mediator is the ability to offer useful assessments of parties' cases based on my subject matter experience. Also, if we ask them, well, who do you talk to before the first mediation session where everyone's coming together? And of course, overwhelmingly, the focus is on counsel. And indeed, we got lots and lots of comments that said, I don't talk to the parties unless and until I've gotten the go-ahead from the lawyers. So again, they think in terms of their, at least their primary relationship being with counsel. And there are a variety of other issues. Here are a whole bunch of questions which we don't have time to go through, looking at all of the different preparatory steps, most of which involve communications with counsel, submissions by counsel, etc. Well, now, this is a natural step, because again, we're talking about resolution of mediated cases. But it does reinforce the notion that we're talking about a very heavily lawyered process. You, again, as you look at what's going on in the mediation, although you see many different approaches, and including different penchants for keeping parties separate or bringing them together or doing both, many different approaches. Now, here's another one that indicates that the active and directive role that some mediators play, where they say, I develop and propose potential agreements the parties might all accept as part of potential settlement. Other people say, well, no, I'm careful not to offer my own opinions. Of course, many, many people use flexible approaches in terms of how directive or elicitive they are. I often refer, just for the sake of kind of a nice anecdote, to my good friend Nina Z. Claiborne in San Francisco, who says, I'm facilitative in the morning, and then I become evaluative in the afternoon. So again, you see a lot of that. Here are some of the responses relating to the sharing of opinions regarding the legal strength and arguments made by parties and counsel. When the report on all of this data comes out, I'll make sure that it's available to you, and I'll also make these slides available. But there's much, much more to say. We really don't have time to get into all of the detail. What I'd like to do is move on and just talk. Let me mention briefly that what's emerging out of our picture of mediation today, and I can tell you that as someone working and observing in California, we have a heavily lawyered process. Not only do lawyers represent parties in the process, but remember, they've got just as much experience as mediators do with mediation in many cases. This can be a wonderful thing for mediation. And most mediators in this survey said, we are glad that lawyers are as experienced as they are, so knowledgeable about the process. But there's also a subtext, which is, many lawyers are gaming the process in different ways. They use the process rather cynically for very limited purposes, and really with the intent of delaying resolution and not trying to accomplish it. Maybe simply obtaining information about another side's case. Also, we've observed certain trends that are mentioned by certain survey respondents, which are to the effect that attorneys are often saying, we don't want joint sessions. We want you to engage in shuttle diplomacy. You talk to the lawyers. We'll handle all of the communications. So they're really shutting down a lot of the avenues in some cases by which mediators are able to do their work. I want to say that as we begin to look into the international milieu, when we're talking about mediation internationally, of course, you're dealing with many, many different cultural backgrounds. And frankly, no country has a longer history of mediation than China. It is, in a sense, part of their blood. And there are many things we could say about mediation. Today, the most visible and formal kinds of mediation occur in the context of what we'll call various wise elder relationships. For example, here's a sign from a People's Mediation Center in central Beijing. And you actually have a person who is in a position of authority in the government hierarchy who actually works back and forth with parties to try to resolve neighborhood disputes and is highly successful in doing that. If you had a dispute with a Chinese party and you ended up in arbitration in China, your arbitrator might say to you, do you want to mediate at this point? And would actually, if the parties agreed, would actually take the time to mediate the case himself or themselves. Or if you go to a Chinese court, and I've actually seen Chinese judges say to parties, would you like me to mediate at this point? And they have the option of trying to have this authority figure, their adjudicator, actually mediate the dispute. Now, sometimes all of the mediation occurs in a single room, in a single setting, or there may be separate ex parte discussions. So in some ways, it's a bit different from what many of you might be accustomed to. Point is, we have these different folk ways, we have these different traditions that have been established. Some years ago, we did training for a number of Chinese judges and arbitrators in Western-style mediation. They said, we want to learn how the Westerners do it, because the idea was we wanted to try to create some kind of common ground for mediation of international commercial disputes. The Beijing Arbitration Commission was a wonderful platform for that. At the end of the day, we were unable to really at least cause our Chinese colleagues to broadly embrace standalone mediation. Interestingly, a number of the people that we trained use mediation as arbitrators, but using some of the skills that they learned. One other thing to think about, frankly, is in thinking about traditions is the role of rule of law. And lately in California, there have been some newspaper articles talking about the fact that, well, maybe mediation can pick up the slack now that the courts are not being funded the way they should be. And, of course, when I've been asked about that, I say, oh, that is as wrongheaded as anything can possibly be. The two things go hand in hand. Mediation is not a substitute for the rule of law. It can't do all of the things that a court system does as a backstop. But that, again, is an important consideration. I want to talk about online dispute resolution and the importance of that. You know, there's really a general reorientation that many of you are experiencing as young people with electronic media. And today we do have some forms of mediation that occur online, although they're typically high-volume, low-dollar disputes. And we're all experimenting with electronic systems of different kinds. The UN is actually looking at setting up standards for online dispute resolution. I think that in time, many of us will have experiences with online conflict modeling and gaming. Be an opportunity to actually model the resolution of a dispute. And in fact, there already are systems by which this can be done. We're also beginning to hear about crowdsourcing opportunities, community courts. Some of us who act as dispute resolvers or judges or arbitrators may be called upon to provide responses to parties online with regard to questions relating to a particular case, liability, damages, etc. It's a quick way to get a fix on resolution of a case. Virtual conferencing and hearings, I think, is going to become much more the rule, particularly when I think about having traveled to the Middle East recently for hearings in a case, and even going to Europe for deliberation with other arbitrators, or for a short preliminary conference of some kind. We're already doing a lot of that by video conferencing, but there'll be more and more opportunities that way. And I have to say, we may even be competing with avatars. I know, perish the thought. Richard Susskind, in his one of his wonderful books some years ago, said, well, we're a long way from having electronic substitutes for humans as mediators or as judges. But just watch. Then there's brain science and data mining. Risk aversion, anchoring, attribution error, reactive devaluation, these are all common terms that we're used to discussing now in courses that lawyers or prospective lawyers take on negotiation or on dispute resolution. We're coming to realize that far from being pure rational beings, humans work with many cognitive filters. We see things through the lenses of our human nature, the intuition that's built into our brain, culture and personality, all of these levels come into play. I actually have a colleague, Don Felbin, who's done some amazing work. If you see him, he'll probably tell you he wants to collect some negotiation data from you. But he's plugged all of this into a system, a set of algorithms that predict results in mediation with uncanny accuracy. And of course, the more information they have, the better. We're also dealing, all of us, with longer lifespans. And people, instead of retiring, will be in active retirement. For many, many years, maybe 20 or 30 or 40 years. So all of this is important. And then finally, regulation and credentialing, which are very much on the minds of many of us. And I have a bit more that I might say, but I think it's more important to try to open up the floor to discussion by everyone. So I hope I've thrown out if not controversial, at least challenging thoughts, and want to invite your comments and interaction. So Nina, I'll stop right there.
Professor, how much your dispute resolution, in the legal sense, actually be applied to the political sense of what's going on in Syria? We've had Martin McCulley saying that the UN Security Council basically failed. We can see that quite specifically in Syria. But how much those same ideas, those same concepts, be applied to Syria? In that situation, seeing that we're getting Russia saying, you go there, we'll build it. So this is a really serious issue.
You know, and I have to tell you that I'm sometimes disappointed at what appears to be the lack of effort, at least that's visible, on the governmental level, the traditional level. I will tell you that my institute has been involved with other organizations in third-track diplomacy. And one of the things that we've been trying to do is actually try to promote bridge-building on the basis of commonalities in different religions. And we have been working in places like Syria, in Jordan, in Egypt, and elsewhere, as well as Israel and the West Bank, trying to look at the common threads, the common foundations in Islam, in Judaism, in Christianity, and try to bring people together. And of course, this is a very, very tedious and often frustrating process where you move a few steps forward and then maybe a few or more steps back. All I can say is that it's going on and that people of goodwill are attempting, a lot of people are attempting to work on it. But right now, we seem to be in our world seems to be about as broken as I can remember it for a while. Of course, we're blessed in places like the U.S. or New Zealand not to have, active conflict going on and have had relative peace for a number of years, not to say that there aren't problems. But I don't like the way things are going. And all we can do is to try, through mechanisms like the ones I referred to try to address them. In the next part of my talk, there's more to say about the role of mediation in trying to address relational issues like this. But the fact is, we can't do enough.
Yes. You mentioned the Oslo Accords, which was a very
yes.
example of
yes.
private networks, albeit supported by the Norwegian government, of course, by other very powerful governments as well, mm-hmm. that led to those accords, which, although largely abandoned, there are some ingredients mm-hmm. of those accords still in place.
Mm-hmm. Very good point.
That's an example of what could be done. The other thing you mentioned is an organization, if you care to Google it,
Media's Beyond Borders.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They have very ambitious goals. I'm skeptical whether they could put any more than a tiny percentage of them into place, but the mm-hmm. heart's in the right place and they need support.
Mm-hmm. For those of you who may not know, Tony Willis sitting at the front here is one of the world's leading mediators. We're very mm-hmm. lucky to have him mm-hmm. with us tonight, but it's a bit of a shame.
That's true.
We've
yes.
more time, but he's yeah. recently been named as the top 10 mediator in the world. So any other questions?
My sort of take on Asia is a reluctance there to have disputes resolved or mediated by Western-type institutions. Mm-hmm. So in the illustration of, say, a dispute between commercial entities in China and India or China and Russia, what sort of organizations do you have a confidence in Asia to guide parties to mediated outcomes?
Well, I have to tell you that as you note, our efforts to really to try to establish something that would be akin to the sorts of mediation approaches that we've talked about in the West or that we actively use have really not borne fruit. Of course, you do have leading mediation centers, Singapore and to some extent Hong Kong International Arbitration Center. Although Tony, maybe you have more or others have more to say about that. My own impression is that there is not a great deal of mediation that has gone on there, at least not involving parties from the PRC and the West. Do you know? Can you comment on that?
The two jurisdictions are interesting because they've both adopted quite powerful schemes to persuade people to go to mediation. Mm-hmm. So, as in England and Wales, the rules of court have since 1999 given judges power to not order, but nonetheless be very persuasive in telling parties to go off to mediation. And so there's a lot of mediation in Hong Kong. I've mediated quite regularly in Hong Kong, and lots of other people have, and they have now panels. Mm-hmm. It is growing. Singapore, in the junior courts in Singapore for a long time, had almost compulsory mediation in the lower courts. It's a subject that interests me because you talked about the various states in the United States where mediation is very, very, very powerful, like some California, not too unfamiliar with, Texas and Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And there are states where all of these drivers are in place. Regulation rules, if the judges were to be active, and that leads to the growth of mediation. Australia has gone to the point where it's compulsory mediation, and the same is the case in places like Canada and Israel and various others. Interestingly enough, my home jurisdiction, for example, my understanding is, and I still say that New Zealand has not yet adopted rules such as adopted in 1999 in England, and therefore there is less volume, is my understanding from Jeff Sharp and others who practice all the time here, and it would be interesting to see, by comparison with Australia, Canada, and all the other countries that have done, what the impact of some rule changes might be.
Professor Stefanovic, in your experience, does enacting regulation actually lead to an increase in cases?
You know, I have to say that the number one reality that favors rapid growth in cases is judicial action of some kind. Everywhere that I have seen it develop, it's because the courts got behind it to one degree or another, mandating it or encouraging it or strongly pushing it, and also in some cases helping to seed it with funding. That's been the primary engine that has evolved. Other kinds of regulation, in agencies certainly there's a large volume of disputes that may be handled that way. But I have to say courts have typically taken the lead.
It's interesting for us to hear because of course in New Zealand our judiciary has been quite skeptical about the concept of mandatory litigation.
Hmm.
In your slides, you talked about paying for appropriate dispute resolution and a couple of slides about relationships. I wonder what you think the implications of that is for the way in which we teach us some of the core courses in most of our rules and law families. For example, draw a contract, there's a sort of a narrative thread that I associate with Ian McNeil about relational theory of contract. Mm-hmm. Start off with relationship rather than qualities of exchange and so on. Do you think that if there's more ADR as an appropriate dispute resolution, there'll be some flow-on effects to the way we teach core subjects?
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up because that was really the focus of, and again, a little bit that we didn't talk about, relationships and the role of facilitators in reinforcing those. Ian McNeil was actually my co-author on the arbitration treatise that we wrote. or I should say I was his co-author. He was a tremendous thinker, and as you say, pioneered this notion of relational contracts. And to me, this is an area that really has not been has been embraced as a focus for the skills that we can bring to bear. I think there, you know, if you reflect on the fact that typically mediators don't get involved until both sides have lawyered up, often a complaint has been filed, you're well into the dispute process. A lot of opportunities have been lost by that point. A good friend of mine, a longtime a litigator, once said that by the time you get to mediation, you've lost your best opportunities. And I certainly think that in certain relational scenarios, relationships that are of high value, great stakes, it's important to try to look at other opportunities there might be for strengthening the relationship. And indeed, there are examples of situations where facilitators have used the insights they've gotten in mediation to do that. And if we had time, I could give you examples of it. But that's actually something we're going to be looking at, and I hope piloting in the coming years. So, in fact, we just had a workshop at Pepperdine 2 weeks ago about that. So, and that was my primary focus. So I'm very, very much focused on those issues.
Yeah. One final question. Okay.
Yes, I just, picking up on your comments about ADR once proceeding and already being filed, and you observed that often that happens quite late in the piece as well. Perhaps one of the reasons for that is that at that stage you've already spent all the money on discovery and money spilled, and they have all the information that
I will tell you that sometimes it lack of information does represent a barrier to a resolution. Frankly, sometimes just cases aren't ripe for resolution until later. But I will say that as a mediator, I always attempted, when I had the opportunity to get involved early, to try to, as part of my work, determine what kinds of information might be necessary. And I would try to help ferret that out if that was necessary to get the dispute resolved. So in some cases, I was actually able to help mediate process issues to get information out on the table that would permit parties to get a quicker result. But you hear a lot of lawyers say, well, I can never mediate a case before it's time. I really need to do my discovery before there is an opportunity to, before I'm really ready to decide whether to settle. Of course, by coincidence, discovery happens to be the portion of the litigation process where lawyers make, at least U.S. lawyers, make the vast amount of their money.
On that note, forced me to wrap up. Before I thank Professor Stefanovic, I have two administrative matters I simply need to announce. The first is, for those of you who are seeking CPD credit for your attendance here tonight, the correct procedure is to get the person next to you to sign the back of your flyer as a way of verifying your attendance. Then the Law Society ever audits your CPD report, so the second thing I'd like to say quickly is a plug for the university for the law school's postgraduate program. Any of you wishing to study more in dispute resolution, have a look at the website. We're really actively trying to build up our programs and mediation now. But plugs aside, and I apologise for the plugs, I for one am very sorry that we run out of time, because I would really like to hear more because this you seem to have, particularly in your statistics, really given us a very clear idea of what's happening at the moment, but also a little bit of a roadmap for what might happen in the future. So thank you very much for your talk and for the questions and the answers.
My sincere pleasure.